Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello. Welcome to Nature Now for the next to last week of August. I'm Charlie Fleischman, donning the host, sound engineer, and editor hats to present this week's show. We are pleased to broadcast an encore of the interview that first aired May 24th, 2017. Jonathan White, author of Tides, the Science and Spirit of the Ocean, visited by phone with host Nan Evans to discuss how the tides can tell time, change our concept of time, and affect living creatures. But first, as always, the mystery sound. A hint, it's not a bird. We'll revisit the sound later in the program to identify its source. And on to some news and observations from our area with reports from all three Nature Now hosts. An interesting sighting was sent in by Mary Robson, who observed the following with her family. Quoting Mary, "Out on the beach near Ozette, a hawk circled and then chased and caught a gull, drove it down to the sand, and killed it quite fast. I'm not sure which hawk, because I was too far to see exactly, perhaps a red-tailed hawk. This bird was determined to get lunch, turned the gull over, and pulled out all the belly feathers, creating a flurry of white in the air and on the sand. It then pulled out bits, eating steadily for about 20 minutes. The bird flew off when about six hikers stopped to watch. It returned immediately when they left and resumed eating until satisfied. Amazing." Deborah Kelso added this item that I quote, "After about 3 weeks of hanging out in my woods, begging to be fed, the two Cooper's hawk juveniles that fledged in my neighborhood seemed to have become independent of their parents and ceased making their insistent calls for food. The first time that I heard the calls, I thought that it was my dog playing outside with his squeaky toy. When I realized that the sound was coming from the treetops, I realized that there was something else going on. The begging call of the juvenile hawk does sound very like this, however, and can be remarkably loud and insistent." And this from Nan Evans. She observed lots of birds just hanging out on the water. She wonders if that's their way of trying to cope with the smoky air. Speaking of the weather, it was a continuous story last week, with several days of smoky skies and unhealthy air. There was more air pollution early this week, and there's an air quality alert for smoke posted through Wednesday afternoon. Children, the elderly, and individuals with respiratory illnesses are most at risk of serious health effects and need to be careful of outdoor exposure to the particulates. If you want to keep track of air pollutant levels in Port Townsend, search online for the Washington State Department of Ecology Air Quality Monitoring website for the latest numbers. Interesting fact, the Port Townsend location is on San Juan Avenue on the roof of the Blue Heron Middle School. Now here's Nan Evans' interview with Jonathan White.
Well, my guest today is Jonathan White, author of Tides, the Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
As I was thinking about today's conversation, I begin to reflect on that old proverb that tide and time wait for no man. So I looked up its origin and found out that it was ancient and very uncertain. The earliest known record was from 1225. And the proverb also appears in some of Chaucer's work in 1395. And of course, we know that in modern usage, the proverb alludes to the fact that human action, events, and concerns cannot stop the passage of time or the movement of the tides. And thus, we had just better get on with it. But what I then learned was that the literal interpretation of tide in that proverb is actually not what the original version meant. Tide did not refer to the rising and falling of the sea, but rather to a period of time. Let's talk with Jonathan about tides and our notion of time. We know that the moon is a sort of prime mover in tides, and we think about the moon and tides as timekeepers. Jonathan, you had a lovely little piece of your book about that. Do you want to read from it for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This is from the second chapter, which is kind of covers the cultural and spiritual history of the tide, and also a section about the moon, as you mentioned. The moon was god and goddess, a gate, a symbol of eternity. It embodied the paradox of change and changelessness. It was also a timekeeper, unlike the sun, which could also be used to measure a time, a day. The moon offered a reliable method for reckoning time over periods of a week or a month. It took 7 days or nights to complete each quarter phase and about 29 days to complete a full cycle. One moon became 1 month. Once these phases were identified, they could also be used as a point of reference between what comes before and what comes after, a context in which to consider the past, present, and future. The earliest known evidence of a moon calendar was discovered in 1967 at the archaeological site in France. Amid layers of artifacts, a flat 4-inch piece of bone was unearthed, dating back to 25,000 BC. On its surface was etched a serpentine-like series of strokes and notches. According to anthropologist Alexander Marshak, who first recognized the bone's significance, the rendering consists of about 70 marks, each depicting the moon's gradual waxing and waning through the two full cycles. Although this small bone is the earliest evidence of a moon calendar, Marshak suggests in his book that the tradition dates back to the Pleistocene, 300,000 to 600,000 years ago. However, early humans began using the moon as primary timekeeper. The practice held sway until the late 16th century, when it was displaced in Europe by the Catholic Church's sun-based Gregorian calendar. As Christianity struggled for footing in the early centuries of the current era, the timekeeping properties and mythology associated with the moon were slowly relegated to the profane. The sun grew to symbolize Christ, and the moon's role as fertility goddess shifted to Mary. Sunday became the Sabbath, a day of rest and worship. Moonday became the first day of the work week. In spite of these large shifts in worldview, many cultures, including pockets within the Christian world, still see the moon as a symbol of spirituality. It's telling that religious holidays such as Easter, Passover, Ramadan, and most Buddhist festivals are timed to the moon. Lunar calendars are still used in China and many Arab countries.
Let's talk a bit about how living organisms are tuned to these tidal cycles. And I know, of course, there is a linkage with human-female menstrual cycles. Most of us know about the notion of circadian rhythms and are sort of how the daylight triggers certain rhythms in animals, humans and others, you know, sleep rhythms, etc. And most of those plants and animals that we think about circadian rhythms in, they're mostly land-based. Tell me about tidal rhythms and how those show up in animals.
Actually, there are many, many, many animals that live in the intertidal zone, offshore or coastal, in one way or another, that are tuned to either tide or lunar rhythms having to do with the coming and going of the tide in the intertidal zone. And I think it's interesting to note, if we take a kind of a half step back, this study of biological rhythms is called chronobiology, and it's been around for some time, not a real long time, but it really was the middle of the 18th century was the first time when a scientific study appeared on this. Even Linnaeus, the father of modern taxonomy, he created a flower clock based on the daily patterns that flowers open and close. And what he did was he set it up where, for example, one kind of flower might open at 3:30 in the morning and then close at 12:30. And then another kind of flower might open at 9 in the morning and close at 4 in the afternoon. So he set these flowers up around a circle, and he could tell time by the opening and closing of these flowers.
That's fascinating.
So it's a really, really fascinating thing. In fact, the mechanical clocks during that time, this is the middle of the 1750 or so, mechanical clocks were really unreliable. So there was rumor that these flower clocks were going to take over and that they would be our way of telling time. It's a fascinating study and field. And of course, as we know, human beings have very broad biological clocks, and any one of us might be tuned to either 22 hours to 26 hours a day, depending on our own biological rhythm. So in other words, if we were isolated, each of us would establish a rhythm somewhere between that 22 and 26 hours a day.
And those are mostly driven by the sun cycle, isn't it?
Well, our inherent rhythm is not necessarily solar, but we are attuned or entrained to the solar day, which is the 24-hour day, of course. But like you were saying, there are many, many creatures that are not tuned to the solar day, but tuned to the lunar day or even to a tidal day. They call that circa-tidal or circa-lunar, which is about those rhythms.
So would that mean that an organism tuned that way would sort of know when the tide's going to be high and when it's going to be low and what it needs to do at those different periods of time?
Yes, exactly. In the first chapter of the book, I talked quite a bit about a very small, like a grain, a rice grain size mud shrimp that has two tide clocks in it. And one tells it what the tide is doing today. And, of course, that changes from day to day. So this is a very sophisticated system. And then it also has a tide clock that tells it when the highest tides for the month are going to be for spawning purposes. This is, a very tiny organism the size of a grain of rice, and has two tide clocks in it. And we don't know how those work, and we don't know where they are in the animal. But we know that they function very, very precisely and tell this little creature how to live in the tide, in a very large tide system. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's the Bay of Fundy.
Well, and we know it's not just mud shrimp. It's clams and oysters and crabs and worms and so on. And I also know, through your book, that there is a professor at the Friday Harbor Labs, Emily Carrington, who has done work on snails or whelks on their tidal rhythms. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, this is a fairly new study. It was a 4-year study done up here in the labs, not too far from where I live. Basically, what Emily discovered was that this whelk, a slow-moving creature that hides underneath the rock down mid-tide range during the higher tides, it makes its way up the intertidal zone during the spring tides, which is a 2-week cycle, right? It's the largest tides of the month. This little whelk has a tide clock within it that tells them when those higher tides are going to be, and then it takes off from underneath its rock and makes the long journey up to the higher part of the tidal zone where it can feed on barnacles, its favorite food, and or mussels. It's not only a slow walker or mover, but it also is a very slow eater. So its favorite food, the barnacle, it drills a hole in it and then inserts its radula, which is a sandpaper-like tongue, and scoops out the meat. And it takes it about 18 hours to eat one barnacle. There's a lot of risk involved for this little whelk to get up there, and a lot of exposure either to air or sun or predators while it's doing this. So it uses the tide to get up and eat this barnacle or whatever it is. So it binges for 3 or 4 days with the tide, and then it makes its way back down and hides underneath a rock until the next highest tides.
You know, it's interesting to think about actually how our sort of activity rhythms and the rhythms of other organisms are triggered by things astral and the tides. There's another section of your book where you have a short discussion of recognition of the moon-tide partnership. I'm wondering if you can read that little bit for us.
Yes, this is in the second chapter of the book. as recognition of the moon-tide partnership grew, it's not surprising that the moon's spiritual qualities were projected onto the ocean. The lunar gods and goddesses, dark and feminine, became gods and goddesses of the ocean. The tides coming and going reflected the moon's coming and going, each inseparable and personified in the other. Like a waxing moon, then, a flooding tide was a time of growth, and an ebbing tide was a time of decay and diminishment. James Fraser writes in The Golden Bough that coastal dwellers were apt to trace a subtle relation, a secret harmony between its tides and the life of man, of animals, and of plants. In the flowing tide, they see not merely a symbol, but a cause of exuberance, of prosperity, while in the ebbing tide, they discern a real agent as well as a melancholy emblem of failure, of weakness, and of death. Animals die only during an ebb tide, said Aristotle. 2,000 years later, Charles Dickens wrote in David Copperfield, "People can't die along the coast except when the tide's pretty well nigh out." If a sickly person survives the ebb, he'll hold his own till past the flood and go out with the next tide.
You know, I got to think about that one. That's not so sure, but the point is made. We sort of think of time as a constant. How does the moon and the tides actually affect time, the sort of physicality of time on the Earth?
As it happens, quite a bit. Tides create friction, a lot of it, by rubbing against the ocean floor. And it's like when we rub our hands together and create heat. Some of that friction, the energy from friction, is dissipated into the ocean itself as heat, but most of it is transferred into energy that slows down the rotation of the Earth.
So that's working like on the ocean floor.
It's tide friction, rubbing against the ocean floor. And basically every time we see a dimple of tension or a current area, which we have a lot on this coast, that is evidence of tidal friction. And that cumulatively around the world is a huge amount, enough to slow down the rotation of the Earth.
Okay, and pause right there. Slowing down the rotation of the Earth, that also means it's going to change day length, right?
That's right.
And the days will get
longer. That's right. So by a very small amount every day, the Earth's just turning slower and our days are getting longer. So 400 million years ago, our days were 21 hours long, not 24 hours long.
Okay, fine. How do we know that?
How do we know that?
Yeah.
Oh, boy, that is an interesting question in and of itself. And it's been speculated for some time, I would say 150 years, it's been speculated. And how it first came up is Edmund Halley, who was responsible for Halley's Comet, and he was the Astronomer Royal in London during Newton's time. Now we're talking 1680 to 1720, 30 or something like that. And he noticed that when he went back to look at eclipse records, and of course we've been keeping eclipse records for thousands of years. It's one of the things the ancient Egyptians and Chinese did with a lot of precision. When he went to look at these old eclipse records, he noticed that if the Earth was rotating at exactly the same speed over time, that those eclipse records, of course, would match up to records now. But when he studied this, he found out that they didn't, that older eclipses were happening earlier than they should.
Based on his mathematical calculations.
That's right. Yeah. Something was awry.
That's a theoretical thing. Can you see evidence in the natural world, like hard evidence?
Well, yes. A number of other people, of course, speculated about this, and this was a very, very slow development over time. But eventually, a guy named John Wells from Cornell University in the 1960s discovered that coral lay down growth rings just like a tree does.
So a coral is, it's pulling out the calcium carbonate, and it grows that way. So, but it actually grows in a way you can see rings.
That's right. You can see daily rings in a coral and also yearly markings. So you can count the rings in the coral and determine basically how many days there were in a year. So, and coral is very old, of course. You know, we are, you know, there's evidence that coral was on Earth 500 million years ago. So that's the other advantage of coral. Well, when John Wells drilled down and analyzed coral that were 400, 500 million years old, he discovered that there were 20 to 22 rings per day, indicating that the days were a lot shorter than they used to be.
So 20 to 22 hours is what that's saying.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, all I can say to our listeners is you got to read this book because we have just completely burned up the time available. So I've got to thank you again, Jonathan. This is fascinating conversations.
Thank you very much, Nan. I appreciate being here with you.
Great. Thanks a bunch.
That was the fourth in a series of interesting and informative conversations with Jonathan, who generously offered his time and expertise to Nature Now last year. If you're interested in listening to any of his previous appearances, click on the KPTZ podcast link at kptz.org and follow it to the Nature Now link on the podcast list page. Work your way back a few pages and look for the interviews in February, March, and April of 2017. Here's that mystery sound again. It's the chirping of a chipmunk, a striped member of the squirrel family. There are four species in Washington, two of which tend to show up in our region. The yellow pine chipmunk is common in the subalpine to alpine zone of the Olympics and likes to ascend high into pines to forage for seeds. The Townsend's chipmunk is usually seen in areas up to the tree line in the Olympics, is larger and darker than the other species, and does not have a clearly defined stripe running from nose to eye like the others. Besides seeds, these animals subsist on nuts, acorns, tree buds, berries, leaves, and twigs. The Townsend's chipmunks are also known to relish birds' eggs. And let's wind up with some upcoming events. Thinking Through the Land, presented by Jefferson Clemente and co-sponsored by the Jefferson Land Trust and Finn River Farm and Cidery, continues its August dialogue series at the Cidery's location in Chimicum. In case you are listening to the show on Wednesday, August 22nd, today's Nature Now guest Jonathan White talks about the science and spirit of tides at 6 p.m. Holly Hughes will be the final series presenter with Poetry for Our Bioregion at 6 p.m. on August 29th. The events are free and open to the public. The Jefferson Land Trust is calling for volunteers for a stewardship work party on August 28th to attack non-native holly at Quimper West Preserve. This worthwhile effort runs from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. and involves hand-pulling and cutting holly that is invading the forested preserve. Check the Land Trust website for details. The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society presents 2 days at Ocean Shores to observe migrating shorebirds of Grays Harbor and other Pacific coastal spots, Tuesday and Wednesday, August 28th and 29th. Pre-registration is required. Visit the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society website and look under the Events tab for information. And remember that every Wednesday morning, the Society hosts a bird walk from 8:30 to 10:30. Meet at the Dungeness River Center in Squim to see and hear the birds of the riparian forest. One of the goals of these walks is to better understand the annual cycle of birds in Railroad Bridge Park. All ages and experience levels are welcome to attend. That's all for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thank you for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is The Moon in the Tide, performed by Derek Gust.
You can tell that they move in time with each other, 'cause they pull each other in, and they push each other out, and there never is a doubt of which way they're heading.